This morning I'm going to be reading from something that I've been looking at a lot in the last while. It's something, a passage that we all know pretty well, I think, but it's necessary in terms of the message I'm going to preach, so I will be reading that again. It's 1 Corinthians chapter 13, and it's a very important piece of scripture. If I speak in the tongues of mortals and of angels but do not have love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give away all my possessions, and if I hand over my body so that I may boast but do not have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It isn't irritable or resentful. It doesn't rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. But as for prophecies, they will come to an end. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will come to an end. For we know only in part, and we prophesy only in part. But when the complete comes, the partial will come to an end. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became an adult, I put an end to childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then we will see face to face. Now I know only in part, then I will know fully, even as I have been fully known. And now faith, hope, and love abide, these three. And the greatest of these is love. Amen. As I've said, I've recently been privileged to lead two marriage services very close together. One, a lovely local couple, and the other, my niece Tanya and her husband Gareth. In fact, I returned on Friday night from the latter because they got married, as most of you might know, in Madeira, where Tanya's mum is from and where the family have a home. And it was a lovely time, but also very busy, as family type things often are, especially when you've got people flying in from all places in the world. And as part of my message to both couples, I used some headings I found in a fashion magazine of all places, in an article entitled Six Factors for a Healthy Married Life. Why was I reading the fashion magazine, you may wonder? Well, I can't remember exactly, but I may have been waiting for someone where they have magazines lying on tables. The article was actually very balanced, so I borrowed the six things or the six headings that were in it. And as I was thinking about today's message amidst all the chaos of family stuff in Madeira and lots of people doing all kinds of things and running about in cars and stuff like that, I figured the things I'd read in the article don't only apply to marriage. They apply to life. They apply to all of us. They are things that make us better people. They are things that make our relationships stronger. I think they are things that are always needed in the world we live in. And so that's what we're going to look at this morning. And the first heading was gratefulness. Be grateful for one another, I said to the newlyweds. Remember that you chose each other. And remember why. We sometimes get on each other's nerves. We sometimes rub each other up the wrong way. We don't always agree. And there may be valid reasons for these things, but it's imperative that we are able to see beyond our grievances or our touchiness and understand that person in terms of the wonder of a human life. and the God-given gifts that we are to one another. And I've often wished I was a fly on the wall when Jesus and his disciples were stomping around Palestine. Because you can bet your bottom dollar that they weren't always floating about on a wave of euphoria. We know from all the snippets that we find in the Gospels, or the small snippets, that there were sometimes arguments amongst the disciples. And one that springs to mind quite easily is the argument about who was the greatest. That's an argument we can see. But put a bunch of men together, and quite possibly some of their families, and people are going to get on each other's nerves, Jesus or no Jesus. And I think Jesus, like Moses, must have had to put up with a lot. It's one of the reasons that I believe Jesus spent time at times away from the group. It's one of the reasons Jesus made a point of stressing that his disciples love each other just as I have loved you. If everyone was running about brimming over with love and goodwill and gratefulness, Jesus wouldn't have had to make sure that his disciples got it, that his disciples understood. Gratefulness is massively important. Second, the call was to cultivate good stubbornness. And what was meant by this was the ability not to simply fold at the first hurdle, not to simply fold at the first bump in the road, but to learn to work through things, preferably together. I think Jesus told his disciples to go out in pairs, not just for simple companionship, but so that they'd have a shoulder to lean on, to be a source of encouragement for each other. We're all different. In this hall today, if we simply just look around, we will know that we're all different. But we can complement each other, and we can be a source of encouragement. Now, even Jesus wasn't an island, and even though it seems that the disciples didn't always do a great job of support, I believe that Jesus needed their presence simply as a human being, so that they could give him encouragement, that they could bless him with strength, and he could do the same for them. And we need the same things. We need to stick together. Third, and this was a good one. Something people don't like. Embrace change. Because everything changes. Sometimes our fortunes, and this is one I battle with, always our bodies. Now, I can go to gym 12 hours a day, but gravity's going to win. The way we are as people, the way we understand the world, these things change, but we do not have to run from it, and we do not have to be afraid of it. We can actually embrace change that is good. And I remember my first day at sea when I joined SAF Marine, which was the company that I worked for and my dad worked for too. I just turned 18. I think it was a day after my 18th birthday. And I was quiet, and I was shy, and I still am those things, even though you might not think that because I stand up here every Sunday. And I was about to leave home for quite a long time. And those were the days when we didn't have email, we didn't have mobile phones, and contact was rare. I remember I eventually, on one of my trips, got to Japan after being at sea for goodness knows how long, and I was able to phone Leandra. But she had to get to my mum's place, and that took half an hour. And the Japanese guy with the telephone was jumping up and down laughing because it was costing me a fortune. But that was the first contact I had with her, and the only contact I had with her in 6 months. My dad drove me down to the ship, my backpack full of lovely, clean, white overalls. I was introduced to the captain. And then I was introduced to the the chief engineer, who was about half my size and had a massive bushy beard. And he greeted me briefly as if I was of no consequence. He chatted to my dad, probably because he had to, because my dad was the director of the company. And then he said, "What the hell are you still doing here? Get into the engine room." And so I did. My dad had some business in town before the ship sailed, and the plan was that he was going to come back before the ship left and say goodbye. But when he arrived to say goodbye, the second engineer, perhaps because my dad was a director and perhaps because he was a bit of an idiot, refused to let me out of the engine room. So I couldn't say goodbye. And that hurt. I wasn't going to see him or the rest of my family for 6 months. And that's quite a long time. So there I sat, poor old me, in a very different world, in the bowels of a ship like Jonah in Leviathan. And I could sink or I could swim, not literally. I chose to make the most of it. And being on that ship, being at sea, molded and shaped me in ways that I'd never imagined it would. I allowed it to change me, and it did. It even spoke into my faith and my understanding of God in quite profound ways. And if I hadn't rolled with the punches, if I hadn't been adaptable, I think my life at sea would have been a misery. And change is often understood as a dirty word. People are often afraid of change. We create a certain worldview, plow a certain furrow, and believe if we only keep our heads down, we should be okay. But by doing so, we miss out on new worlds that might be flying by without us even noticing. We miss out on broadening our horizons. We miss out on things that actually might enrich our lives. Now, people used to think that once our brains, for example, were fully formed, that result was set in stone. That result was rigid. But today we know that that isn't accurate. The brain has a plasticity about it. New neural pathways can be created that allow us to adapt to different conditions. And theologically speaking, I know that what I call my faith has changed in the time that I've been a Christian. I'm far less dogmatic than I used to be as a youngster. I understand the purpose of the Bible in a different way. I've also come to understand my purpose in a different way. And it wasn't change for change's sake, because I'm not a big fan of that. It was change that was driven by a passion for my faith and my following of Jesus. It was a change that took place over the decades as I asked more questions and delved deeper into what life might be about. Jesus wanted people to embrace good change. A part of what he sought to do was reform aspects of their faith, to change it. Not to necessarily start a new faith, but to reform it. But we know that the majority of people, it seems, didn't want it. And I believe there are reasons for this. I believe, for example, that over the centuries, they had got used to the burden of their faith and all the going through the motions of what they were taught that faith should be and what faith should look like. The ritual and the sacrifice and the fact that every moment of every day, everything they did from the time they woke up to the time they went to sleep was accounted for and saturated in religion. And when Jesus came along, even though we might say his message was liberating, they didn't have the inclination to actually listen very carefully. In other words, I believe for a lot of them, the change was just too much. And of course, there were others like the religious leaders who didn't want anything to change. Firstly, because they were comfortable with the status quo and they had power and control over people's lives. They called the shots, and they did so in the name of God. And we too need to be careful of these things because we might just miss something life-affirming that is staring us in the face, and that which we are claiming is in the name of God may actually be far from it. Fourth, and this might sound like an absolute no-brainer, but it isn't. It's vitally important. Be nice to each other. I've just come from a family get-together, and I had to remember that. Treat each other with dignity and respect. Now, I've often found that when people are familiar with each other, especially in important relationships, they treat one another, they can sometimes treat one another as if they have ownership of that person, as if they have the right to be controlling, as if they have the right to speak to each other in an undignified way. I think it's fair to say that sometimes relationships are tough or difficult, but when dignity and respect, being nice to each other, is absent, it devalues both parties as human beings. One of my favorite, my all-time favorite aspects of the character of Jesus is the fact that Jesus treated people with both dignity and respect. I think it's the reason why those who did listen to him, those who did follow him, wanted to be with him in the first place. Because he was good to them. And Paul writes, love isn't angry or boastful or rude. It doesn't keep a list of wrongs. It should be hauled out every time a loved one says or does something wrong. We are not each other's doormats. We are not each other's punch bags in any way, shape, or form. We shouldn't be treating strangers better than those we claim to love. Be nice to one another. Fifthly, be empathic or empathetic. Jesus was a master at this. Because he loved, he was able to step inside another's shoes. Because he emptied himself, so to speak, for the sake of others, he was able to feel what they felt as human beings. And that emptying is important because if we are only ever filled with the things of self, we will never or we will struggle to be empathetic. In Jesus, we witness this. In him, we witness no fear of the other. We witness understanding. We witness gentleness. We witness compassion, the building blocks of empathy, of living in another's shoes. And with regards to Christianity, and I've used this quote before, a Christian author wrote that often the biggest problem with Christians is the fact that they want to be right, but not compassionate. Countless times I've watched what we might call souped-up Christians supposedly coming alongside others, mostly non-believers, and simply bombarding them with religious stuff rather than listening, badgering them instead of sharing a conversation. And this simply pushes people away because there's nothing attractive in it. I watched one young man not so long ago standing on his soapbox in Princess Street. It's the first time I've seen that. Berating the shoppers as they walk by with all kinds of religious things. And that is what they did. They walked by. And you can bet your bottom dollar that that young man went home feeling justified because the masses didn't want to hear what he had to say, just like Jesus. The difference between his good news and that of Jesus being compassion. The difference being a distinct lack of empathy, a willingness to speak and believe oneself to be right without being willing to listen, to empathize, to put himself in other people's shoes. And I realized he was young. And I have to admit, I came away from that experience quite angry at the fact that the young man had no idea what was happening in the lives of the people who were passing him by. And yet he took it upon himself to condemn. Silence, wrote St. John of the Cross, is God's first language. Speak little and do not meddle in others' matters about which you are not asked. Preach the gospel, it is thought St. Francis said, and if necessary, use words. Finally, this morning, our sixth pillar, so to speak, the pillar named grace. The Greek word for grace used in the New Testament is charis, the root of a number of words that we use in English, and it is understood to mean a free gift. The Apostle Paul speaks about being justified by his grace as a free gift. In fact, Paul uses the word frequently. But we do have to be careful because there's actually no such thing as a free gift, only a free offer, which becomes a free gift when it's accepted. According to the Christian author and scholar Marcus Borg, Paul's good news, his gospel, is that God's righteousness, that is God's very character as distributive justice, is a grace, a free gift offered to us all absolutely and unconditionally for our justification. That is for our collaboration with God in the transformation of God's world. Now, we aren't God, as I'm sure all of you have noticed, but we can live grace-filled lives. And perhaps grace for us might be as simple as this: remaining kind in difficult or cruel situations. Being confident in our faith and trusting in God in any situation, living without fear, maintaining our dignity, and always seeking to love Jesus and to follow Him. What it doesn't mean is allowing oneself to be used as a doormat. Jesus exuded grace. We're told in John that he came into this world full of grace and truth. In everything he did, he extended a hand of love. And in terms of marriage and of friendship, grace could simply mean cutting each other some slack, giving each other space, giving each other perhaps the benefit of the doubt, giving space for forgiveness and letting it work its God-given magic. And when I think of the issue of grace and Jesus in the gospel, or in the gospels, my mind is filled with a number of images, from the Roman centurion who longed for his servant to be healed, to Zacchaeus entertaining Jesus in his home, to the man who was lowered by his friends through someone's roof. But the image that always blows me away is the one of Jesus dealing with a young woman who was allegedly caught in adultery. What we witness in Jesus is grace. What we witness is in Jesus is such gentleness, grace and gentleness that anger and condemnation could never compete with. Our world needs grace. Our world needs gracious people, people who trust in God with great and quiet confidence rather than believing that they have to put out every fire or plug every hole. The Lord, wrote St. John of the Cross again, measures our perfection neither by the multitude nor the magnitude of our deeds, but by the manner in which we perform them. Of course, there are many more things than six simple things that make for good marriages or make good relationships. But if we simply ponder these things and put them into practice, our lives, I believe, our relationships will be transformed for the good. But it is a journey. Let's make these things part of that journey. Amen. If you're wondering if I preached this message that long at the weddings, which is probably twice as long as the one that was at Harry and Meghan's, no, the answer is no. I expanded somewhat. Just need to put this off.